Chapter 28. The Last Choice Left. Land.
Ah, here it comes.
Land braced for the inevitable moronic phrases, pitched to rouse the feelings of fools and stir the hearts of imbeciles. The calls to arms, the promises of victory. Yes, yes, yes. The Primarch beat his wings with his back to the enemy. He faced the defenders upon the wall, his pinions keeping him aloft as the dawn's pathetic light did its best to spark flares from the edges of his golden armour. Hololithic incarnations of his hovering form flickered into life across Vambrace consoles and view screens within the keep. They sprang up from handheld projectors, thousands of identical tiny blue light ghosts with beating wings. Sanguinius's words carried across the kilometres of elevated wall, brought to distant ears on the clicking, ticking, crackling speakers of servo skulls and mechanicus drones. Soldiers clustered around their data slates to bear witness to the Primarch's proclamation. The 100,000 defenders of the Delphic battlement, drawn from all across the burning Imperium, listened to the words of the great angel. All of them could see him, even if they were far from his sight, then forced to rely on a hololithic reflection. All of them could hear him, even if his words purred through the crackling mouth of a floating probe. Land had expected a speech dripping with demagogic inspiration. He'd find it tawdry, but knew that most of the human defenders, many of whom responded far more positively to the Primarchs than the Mechanicus did, would find great value in such a display. But that was not what he, nor any of them, received.
"I do not want to be here," Sanguinius told them. "I do not want this present, and I want the future that follows even less. We stand against our own brothers and sisters, with our backs to the Eternity Gate, and this is not a battle we can win. If you have ever wondered how you will die, now you know. If you have ever wondered where your body will lie, now you know. You will be killed on the last wall between hope and horror. Your body will lie here, unburied, staring up at a poisoned sky. Once the sanctum falls, terror falls with it. And I tell you, we cannot hold this wall. You can see it yourselves. They are too many. We are too few. We may last a week, if we do the impossible. More likely, we will all be dead in 3 days. Perhaps my words surprise you, or frighten you. But I will not lie. Not to you. Not to you who have come through 200 days of dread, only to find yourselves here. I have looked into your faces and seen what this war has cost all of you. I have followed the flow of battles that each of you have survived to stand here on the final battlement. I see everything you have endured, those stories written in the light of your eyes. Now the War Master offers you the lie of life, promising a mercy his forces are incapable of showing, if we will abandon this last wall. And it falls to me here and now to tell you to stand against him one more time, to give everything you have, even your lives, if it will hold this rampart for another day, another hour, another second. That is what the moment demands of me, is it not? That I beg you to make one last sacrifice?
Sanguinius swooped closer to the battlement, casting his sword to the stone. It clattered there in a loose cluster of blood angels, none of whom made any attempt to pick it up. Lan stared at it for a long moment, then watched as the Primarch whirled in the sky to face the wall once more, showing his bare hands to the gathered thousands.
No.
Sanguinius fairly breathed the word. His wings beat hard, holding him aloft. He stared into the silence that met his disavowal, and he shook his head to punctuate the syllable with adamance.
No, I will not ask it of you. You have already given everything. You have already done everything asked of you 100 times and more. You have suffered through a war of unimaginable darkness, one that has demanded more from you than any soldier in the history of our species has been forced to give. The fact you still live, that you still fight, I cannot conceive of the courage and resilience it requires for you to face this dawn and look to the horizon with a rifle in your hands. Land could hear army soldiers shuffling. He saw them glancing at each other. None of them spoke. All of them held rapt to the Primarch's words. Where Horus has offered only lies, I will offer you truth. Those of you that wish to run, run. Leave this place. Not in shame at a duty undone, not in surrender to the traitor's forces, but with honour. Go with my gratitude, for you have already given everything asked of you. What right do I, does anyone, have to demand more? From you, who have endured harrowing beyond account, horror beyond measure. If you wish to fall back into the Sanctum Imperialis and spend the last hours of life with your children, then do so. Know that you go not only with my blessing, but with my envy. If you wish to leave the wall and take your chances in the wasteland before the battle begins, then in the Emperor's name you have earned the right to try. Go swiftly, and carry with you the pride that you have already given a hero's share in a war that none of us wanted but were forced to fight. And if you wish for the truth, I will give it to you gladly, for you have earned that too. It shames me to admit, but I would abandon this wall if I could. The Primarch in me, the supposed demigod, half of my heart, craves life with a ferocity that shames me. If I bowed to that instinct, I would take to the sky and never look back. But I cannot. I am half human. And the human in me demands that I stay. Sanguinius turned, looking over his shoulder at the retreating emissary. Daughter of Torment was a quarter of the way to her lines now. When he looked at the wall once again, all could see the resolve in his eyes. There are legends about me. I hear them whispered among you every day, that I know the moment of my own death. The stories say this gives me courage, that I feel no fear because I know I cannot yet be slain. Here is the truth of that tale. That prophesied death is coming. Today, tonight, tomorrow. I know not the when or the how, only that I feel fate's breath on the back of my neck. I do not remain here out of immortality's courage. I remain here because if I am to die, I choose this death. I choose to die with my back to the last door. I choose to give my life to buy another hour, or a minute, or even a single second of grace to those who cannot be here fighting with me. I choose to die here, because I do not believe I have yet given all I can. Someone must stand and fight, and if I have but one choice left, I will make it now. I will stand. I will fight. I will hold this wall, knowing that the 13th Legion makes for Terra with all speed. And if they cannot bring salvation, they will bring retribution. Whether I am alone, or whether 100,000 of you are by my side, when the War Master's horde descends upon this wall, they will find me waiting for them with a blade in hand. Not because I can win, but because it is right. I do not know what delusion grips those out there who were once our brothers and sisters, but I know it is right to oppose them. Silence drifted over the Delphic battlement, but only for a moment,
Sanguinius swept his arm across the wall, taking in the defenders. Thousands of hollow ghosts of his image did the very same thing.
I have spoken enough. You need hear no more of my fears and confessions. All that remains is for me to ask, will you run?
At first, in the face of the great angel's honesty, there was no answer. Corporal Mashragir of the 91st Hindustani Drop Troops didn't know what to say. Reason and duty warred within him, in a way known to any soldier facing the grimmest odds. He could live. He could leave and live. His regiment wasn't made for this kind of fighting anyway. They were guerrillas, drop troops, trained for point insertion. He'd been on the ground for this whole damn war. What use was a grav trooper on a rampart? What use was high atmosphere jump training when all he had now was a las rifle and a bayonet? But he was making excuses, justifying, and he knew it. Mash had the training and the experience to overcome these doubts, to push them back and summon focus in their stead. Besides, there was nowhere to run. Not really. Tactically, it made sense to hold here. If he was going to die, best he sell his life where it would matter most. No, he called to the Primarch. And he wasn't the first, but he was one of them. His voice cut out from the silence in the very first wave of denials. He wouldn't leave the wall. He wouldn't run. No! Skitari didn't celebrate birthdays. Magna Delta 8V8 was no exception to this, though her macroclade, the series of platoons and structured hierarchies that defined not only her military position, but also her entire social existence, had a tradition of honouring the anniversaries of a soldier's first combat. Due to the constant casualties and replenishment in a macroclade deployed to a theatre of conflict, it meant these acknowledgements were frequent, minor things. The exact axiom translated poorly from Skit code into any variant of Gothic, but the meaning was more or less, every day is someone's anniversary. The custom usually involved the exchange of gifts, often repeatedly re-gifted within a regiment, since Skitari were permitted so few possessions of their own. Today was Magna Delta 8V8's combat anniversary. Only hers, out of those that remained, because so few of them were left. It didn't matter that the avatar of the Omnissiah himself was at work in the fortress behind her. It didn't matter that the Horde on the horizon outnumbered and outgunned them an incalculable number of times over. These would have been considerations, of course, on any other day, and she would have stood and fought according to the Binharic diktat of duty. Today, though, these concerns were irrelevant. There was no chance she would run on her battle anniversary. Temptation had teased even her strip-mind brain, of course. She was partially human and wholly mortal. But what sealed the decision in Sacred Steel was when three of her surviving Cladekin came to her in the minutes before the ninth speech. They bore gifts. Benevola 91955 had given her a pebble from the slopes of Olympus Mons, the highest mountain on Mother Mars. Jurispruder Garnet 12 had given her a translator data slug to replace the one she'd lost herself months before. Kane Gamma A67 had given her a fistful of loose ammunition in lieu of any personal effects. He had nothing else to give. Magna Delta 8V8 felt the weight of these gifts, these precious and talismanic gestures, in the folds of her cloak as she listened to the ninth Primarch speak. And when the ninth asked the last question, she was ready with her answer. She couldn't vocalize it, at least not in Gothic, but her defiant shriek of Skit code was much of a muchness. Lorelei Kelvier wasn't supposed to be here. If she'd been able to summon the strength to laugh, she'd have surely cut loose with a raw bark of nasty, sarcastic amusement now. She'd been press-ganged, of course. Before the war's opening bombardments, they'd dragged her from a life sentence in the cold tunnel guts of the Sevastopol mining spire and she'd honestly believed it would be easy to get out of ever getting sent to the line. Frankly, she'd not been able to believe her luck. Serving 20 years in the resource-starved mines for crimes she hadn't committed, that her own family had forced her to take the fall for, and suddenly she was dragged back into the sunlight, handed a knife and a rifle, and posted far from the prying eyes of her prison overseers. Fortune smiled at last, and it had a lot to make up for. But that had been, what, a year ago now? It wasn't that she'd never been able to escape. Quite the opposite. She'd escaped easily, and more than once. The first time she'd made a break for it with several others, and one of her companions had killed a sentry on their way out of the temporary barracks. They left the poor sentry in a strangled heap, in a service locker, and fled only to find themselves lost in the palatial chaos of the trans-European Magrail Nexus. Disappearing into the crowds had been easy. Choosing the right train to stow away on had been an exercise in frustration. Every route, every single one, was transferring troops to one future warfront or another. And so her first escape attempt saw her leaving not only her regiment, but the entire sector, only to end up 1,000 kilometres away, disembarking in a crowd of troops immediately subsumed into this new regiment. The Legionis Astartes officers at the end of the line refused all her entreaties. As far as they were concerned, she was there. She was with the regiment, and with them she'd stay. Her next escape attempt had been painfully tantalising. After several weeks within her second regiment, she'd managed to fall in with a group of believers in the new faith. Frankly, she didn't think cult was too strong a word for them. And listening to them prattle about the God Emperor was both nauseating and uncomfortably inspiring. She knew everything they were saying was desperate nonsense. But if it had been true, well, they believed in a beautiful idea, sure enough. Never had she so wished for a religion to be real. This new association had allowed her a chance to slip along to their underground prayer gatherings, which in turn had let her make contact with an administratum liaison attending the sermons, who had been easy enough to convince into having her reassigned. All it took was professing visions of faith in the God Emperor, and he believed her touched by divinity. Lorelei was reasonably certain he'd fallen for it anyway. If it had succeeded, it would have elevated her to some position of pathetically minor authority, overseeing the monotasks of servitors in a warehouse somewhere. If only her deployment orders hadn't come through ahead of her transfer. She'd been waiting, down to the last moments on the Magrail platform, casting about in the shrinking hope that her transferal notation would come through before she was finally forced, at the threat of a baton beating, to board the train. Supposedly the War Master's fleet would reach Terra soon. She was running out of time. Lorelei had escaped again 3 nights later. She had no regrets at all about abandoning her second regiment, and in the weeks after she tore loose, she managed to lie low in the crud shanties clustered at the base of Praxia Hivespire. There she lived in a ramshackle lean-to, abandoned by its previous inhabitants. Likely they were press-ganged into service themselves. She'd scavenged up the basics of survival for several weeks that time, living like a homeless queen alongside a few other deserters. But food was scarce to begin with, and only got scarcer. Soon enough, they'd turned on each other, and it was time to bleed or leave. At first, Lorelei made sure she wasn't the one bleeding by cutting deals with the right brutes. But she'd hoarded too much, was too good at scavenging. Soon she became a victim of her own success. The scum ganged up against her and came for her with chains and scrap daggers. So farewell, Praxia. Farewell, crud shanty house. After that, well, desperation had set in. She did the one and only thing in her life she was ashamed of. Someone had died so she might live. What followed was a period of pretending to be a Munitorum scribe, though was it really pretense when she'd been damn good at the craft? She'd actually done the work, which in her eyes made her a legitimate contender for the trade. It had been protracted, achingly dull stuff, but easy for all that. Following regiments around, taking stock of supplies, and so on, unto tedious infinity. Her ident documents were even legitimate, though that was largely because they weren't hers. They'd belong to the woman she'd killed in order to take her place in the endless grind of imperial bureaucracy. A slice of dumb misfortune saw her busted by an otherwise useless administrator captain, and for no reason beyond a simple mistake in calculations. She was supposed to be savant grade, was she not? Why, yes, it said so on her documentation. How could she make a mistake like this? Why were her resource projections skewing so wide of the actualities? She'd considered bribing him, which was a laugh because she had nothing to bribe him with, and she'd even considered killing him, which was twice the joke, since this was no scrawny, nutrition-stunted tallyer of accounts. This was a retired army soldier, twice her weight, and backed up by the crude strength of a bionic arm. Besides, she was in the thick of it then, deep in the coggy bowels of the Munitorum's processes, and even sneezing would leave a paper trail. She ran, literally fleeing into the night, hiding in a nameless slum town in the shadows of yet another beautiful spire. If they caught her, they'd execute her. It took no time at all for her to be press-ganged in another wave of mandatory recruitment, and her protests availed her nothing. Practically everyone on the planet not serving in an essential position was recruited into the Imperial Army, and so Lorelei was discharged and assigned to her 3rd Regiment, temporarily barracked and gearing up to be sent to yet another sector, where they'd inevitably reinforce the other conscripts already stationed there. Her crime and previous desertions went uncovered, so there was that at least. She was seemingly destined to fight in the war, though, against all efforts to the contrary. That was it. She was being sent to fight in the line. And for a time she had, for months. Months of starvation and privation, months of blinking smoke from her eyes and standing in trenches next to men and women that shat themselves at night to keep warm, and pretending she was better than them, that they belonged there and she didn't, while she grew more gaunt, more sour, day by blood-soaked day. Months of night-fighting and seeing her platoon mates eviscerated and crucified and burst open with bolter fire and carved apart with chainswords. Months and months of what everyone else was also going through, being pawns in the Astartes War. And now, after everything, now this. The great angel himself saying she could run.
"Law," said the soldier next to her.
"You're right." Her squad, all 7 of them still alive, were huddled together in a scrimmage that reeked of sweat and crap and charred earth, watching the flickering hololith projected from Sergeant Gathis's vambrace. Lorelei felt tears on her face. Was she all right?
Oh, yeah. She was great. Just wonderful.
She wasn't the only one showing emotion, either. It wasn't weeping, exactly. It was a slow leak of emotion, too weary to really be called weeping.
"My name's not Lorelei," she said, cuffing the tears from her cheeks.
She had no idea why she was crying. It was like she'd been punctured, and now it was just trickling out of her.
"It's actually Danica."
Her squad were looking at her now.
"Lorelei Calvier was just some Munitorum menial. I killed her months ago. Took her name. I hate that I did it. I wish I hadn't."
She looked up, meeting their eyes. To a soul, they regarded her with depleted acceptance. No anger, no disgust, no judgment at all. Not after all they'd been through as a unit.
"I was trying to get out of the war," she told them. "I didn't want to fight in the line. This was before I met all of you. You're not even my 1st Regiment. This is just the only one I couldn't escape from. Throne, I'm so tired. We can finally run. Finally leave all this shit behind us, and I'm so bloody tired."
Her exhausted tears gave way to laughter. Weak laughter. And weary, but true.
We're not running, Law,
Sergeant Gathis said gently. On his vambrace, Lord Sanguinius had finished speaking. The Primarch asked his last question, and already the shouts of "No, no!" rang out across the Delphic battlement. It was getting hard to speak over it.
I know, she called back over the yelling. Neither am I.
Danica and her squad mates added their voices to the chorus. It would be a poor joke indeed to say that no one wanted to leave the wall in the wake of the Primarch's words. Many wished to run. More than a few came close. But there were as many reasons to stay as there were defenders upon the wall. Every soul there fused some combination of anger, guilt, and shame, cobbling them together to make a piecemeal courage, the way people always do in their bleakest moments. Some stayed out of duty, others out of hope, deluded or otherwise, that reinforcements may yet reach them. Some stayed only because the resolve of those around them shamed them into staying. Some stayed because Sanguinius was right. They'd already given everything, and they had nothing worthwhile left to lose. Their lives were formalities by that point, a matter of biological habit, while the war had worn them down to hollow shells, devoid of everything that had defined their lives. Some stayed because they were sick of running, and after 200 days of defensive withdrawals, this was it. This was the last battle, and they would hold the wall out of tired spite. Land would wonder, years later, if anyone truly did try to run. Surely some did. Were they restrained by companions or shot in the back by their officers? Were they allowed to quit the wall unopposed, as the Ninth had promised? It seemed likely, statistically certain, in fact, that this was the case, but each time he turned his goggles back towards the Royal Ascension, leading up to the Eternity Gate, the gate stood open, disgorging a stream of soldiers and materiel. No one seemed to be going against the flow to venture inside. Nor did he see anyone making their way down from the wall to take their chances in the wasteland. Perhaps if Land and the men and women like him, precious few though they are in any era, had a firmer understanding of the human condition, it wouldn't have been such a surprise that so many stayed when there was a choice to flee.
No!
Cried the defenders of the wall. They rejected the Primarch's offer with a gestalt sound of vocal thunder.
No! No! No!
Land didn't shout with the others. He wasn't one for the theatrics of yelled defiance. Still, there was something rather primal in the way the tumult washed over him. At one point he caught himself drawing in a shaky breath, almost joining his voice to the others. He resisted, naturally. What an embarrassing loss of decorum it would be to join in. Given all that Sanguinius had said regarding every moment mattering, and given the way Zephon had impressed upon him the vital import of doing all they could not to provoke the enemy into attacking early, Land blinked several times, entirely taken aback, when Sanguinius landed on the battlement, caught the blade Amit tossed to him, and launched into the air once more. Land's beaky nose scrunched up in disbelief as he watched the great angel soar towards the eastern horizon. Along the wall, the cries of negation melted, fused into a roar. The sound was exultant, bloodthirsty, joyous. Land had never heard its like. Sapien, perched on Land's shoulder, covered his little ears. The Martian's disbelieving words were drowned by the tide.
Tell me he's not going to kill that Titan.
Somehow Zephon heard his murmur over the bellowing thunder. The Blood Angel looked down at him, and Land was gratified by the cacophony, for it doubtless spared him another lecture. This one would be on the tenuous balance of morale, and capitalizing on the defender's high emotions, and a whole host of other nonsense that only applied to men and women unable to regulate their emotions through a healthy sense of distance and perspective. Judging from the storm of voices, though, it would have been a difficult point to refute. The loss of their hour would be a sacrifice. But the boost to morale after Sanguinius's speech and whatever he planned to do out there in the wasteland was apparently a worthy exchange. Land manually refocused his goggles and gazed across the cursed ground. Not watching the Titan, no, nothing to see there. A genetic abomination god cutting off the cockpit head of an apostate avatar of the Omnisire. Yes, yes, yes. Nothing that Land hadn't already seen half a dozen times in this war. His attention was on the distant tide of the enemy lines and the crucifixion forest they'd raised to celebrate their barbarity. Two things happened when the Reaver's head fell. The first, the most obvious, was that the Horde's front lines started to move. Land wasn't even sure they had waited. They might have already started advancing before the Titan's head struck the earth, kicking up a cloud of ash and dust. Ahead of the Titans and tanks, ahead of the great walking things that Land suspected were some heretofore unknown strain of biomechanical siege weapons, a host of jagged winged creatures darkened the sky above the Horde's vanguard. They cut the heavens ahead of the Horde, making for the Ninth Primarch alone on the field of battle. The second thing that happened, concurrent with the first and visible only because Land turned his goggles towards the god machine's body, was that Sanguinius immediately turned back and made for the battlement. Daughter of Torment did not fall right away. Her graceless tumble came almost a minute after her decapitation, when, brainless, she could no longer regulate the energy animating her bones. At that point she fell forward and slightly sideways, gouting reactor fire from her severed throat. By that point, the sky was vile with thousands of winged creatures, exoplanar aberrations, demons, if you wish to be crude about such matters, beating their chiropteran wings as they chased the great angel back towards sanctuary. Perhaps halfway to the rampart, the creatures in the sky began to slow. Some faltered, circling back. Others dropped from the sky, these weaker ones disintegrating before they could even hit the earth. The largest, swiftest, or strongest in ways Land's eyesight couldn't easily determine, flew on in pursuit. But they were bursting, bleeding, their forms threatening to come apart with each beat of their wings. So fascinating was their destruction that Land, who prided himself on his acuity, took a moment to realize he was witnessing the Omnisire's psychic shield still in force. He laughed aloud, delighted by the sight, only to find the sound lost in the cheers rising all around. And that was strange enough to make his skin crawl, sharing a moment of joy with so many people around him. Sanguinius landed on the rampart in a skid, sparks spraying from his golden boots as they slid across stone, his wings spread wide to slow himself down. His sword was still marked with holy oils and lubricants from where it had chopped through the bindings of Daughter of Torment's neck. The cheering redoubled. Sapien covered his ears again. The great angel whirled back to face the horizon's tide, seconds at most from being in range of the wall guns. "Legion!" he called. "Legion!" The order was taken up along the wall, officer to officer, and shouted further across the vox. Land could hear it rippling away in a stream of retreating sound, like a dissipating echo. "Legion! Legion! Legion! Legion!" In a crashing harmony of Ceramite, the Astartes, all the Astartes, stepped forward. The human defenders had no choice but to move back. Drilling and training took over. The mortal defenders scrambled out of the way. A line of warriors in Blood Angels Red took their place at the ramparts, their uniformity broken only by patches of Imperial Fists yellow and White Scars white. Tens of thousands of bolt guns lifted, braced in readiness. "Let them break upon us," Sanguinius ordered. And Land realized, with an unexpected sense of awe, that the great angel wasn't addressing his legion. He was beating his wings again, calling out to the humans that massed behind the Astartes' lines. "You have your orders," Sanguinius called to the army units and the civilians with their unfamiliar guns. His voice was calm as it carried across the closest squads and was transmitted onward over the vox. "You know your roles. Hold and lend aid where you can. But let them first break upon us." Sanguinius.
No, he is the ninth. He's the ninth Primarch, dammit.
Turned back to face the foe. Still distant, but close enough for... The great angel's sword swept down. The million guns of the Sanctum Imperialis started singing.